Hello, I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch, and it's time for our birthdays. Happy birthday to Donna Seliger of West Des Moines. Happy birthday to you, Donna. If today is your birthday and you didn't hear your name, give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. And now let's get back to the news with our first story from the USA Today. Written by Cedar Anastasio and Julie Carr Smith. With Congress stalled, states rush for virus aid, lawmakers from both parties sounding the alarm. Dateline, Santa Fe, New Mexico. Faulting inaction in Washington, governors and state lawmakers are racing to get pandemic relief to small business owners, the unemployed, renters, and others whose livelihoods have been upended by the widening coronavirus outbreak. In some cases, elected officials are spending the last of a federal relief package passed in the spring as an end-of-the-year deadline approaches and the fall COVID-19 surge threatens their economies. Democrats have been the most vocal in criticizing President Donald Trump and the GOP-controlled Senate for failing to act, but many Republican lawmakers are also sounding the alarm. The number of new COVID-19 cases reported in the United States reached 205,557 on Friday, according to data from Johns Hopkins University, the first time its daily figures topped the 200,000 mark. Its previous daily high was 196,000 on November 20th. The total number of cases reported in the United States since the first one in January has topped 13 million. The Democratic governors of Colorado and New Mexico convened special legislative sessions to address the virus-related emergency. Last week, the New Mexico legislature passed a bipartisan relief bill that will deliver a one-time $1,200 check to all unemployed workers and give up to $50,000 to certain businesses. If the federal government doesn't stand up and step in, we're in a very bad situation for our schools, colleges, and universities, healthcare programs, childcare, senior services, said Illinois House Majority Leader Greg Harris, a Democrat. This isn't like all the blue states are hurting and all the red states are humming along. Everybody's in bad shape. In Colorado, a special session scheduled for Monday will consider roughly $300 million in relief to businesses, restaurants and bars, child care providers, landlords, tenants, public schools, and others. In New Jersey and Washington State, Republicans, who are a minority in both legislatures, were the ones pushing for special sessions. Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin, who control both houses of the legislature, are considering whether to return in December to address effects of the latest coronavirus wave after Democratic Governor Tony Evers put together a $500 million COVID-19 relief bill last week. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is a Democrat. He plans to convene lawmakers in December to contend with the virus. In Ohio, Governor Mike DeWine and legislative leaders pushed a $420 million pandemic spending package through a special bipartisan panel late last month. Pennsylvania House Majority Leader Kerry Benninghoff, a Republican, gives credit to the federal government for the billions in aid previously sent out, but he said small businesses and people who have lost work need more federal assistance. The election's over, he said. This is not a time for finger pointing. The photo accompanying this article has a caption that reads, Angelica Coral changes her personal protective equipment as she travels from room to room at a hospital in El Paso, Texas. And it shows a picture of a medical professional changing her mask. From the Associated Press, CDC panel to vote on vaccine priority. Dateline Atlanta. A panel of U.S. advisors was scheduled to meet Tuesday to vote on how scarce initial supplies of a COVID-19 vaccine will be given out once one has been approved. Experts have proposed giving the vaccine to health workers first. High priority also may be given to workers in essential industries, people with certain medical conditions, and people age 65 and older. Tuesday's meeting is for the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, a group established by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The panel of experts recommends who to vaccinate and when, advice that the government almost always follows. The agenda for next week's emergency meeting was posted Friday. Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech have asked the Food and Drug Administration to allow emergency use of its COVID-19 vaccine candidate. Moderna Incorporated is expected to seek emergency use of its vaccine soon. FDA's scientific advisors were to hold a public meeting December 10th to review Pfizer's request and send a recommendation to the FDA. Manufacturers already have begun stockpiling coronavirus vaccine doses in anticipation of eventual approval, but the first shots will be in short supply and rationed. From Ben Fox, writing for the Associated Press, Biden gives Guantanamo prisoners hope. Dateline Washington. The oldest prisoner at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center went to his latest review board hearing with a degree of hope, something that has been scarce during his 16 years locked up without charges at the U.S. base in Cuba. Saifullah Paracha, a 73-year-old Pakistani with diabetes and a heart condition, had two things going for him that he didn't have at previous hearings: a favorable legal development and the election of Joe Biden. President Donald Trump had effectively ended the Obama administration's practice of reviewing the cases of men held at Guantanamo and releasing them if imprisonment was no longer deemed necessary. Now there's hope that that will resume under Biden. Those pushing for its closure now see a window of opportunity, hoping Biden's administration will find a way to prosecute those who can be prosecuted and release the rest, extricating the U.S. from a detention center that costs more than $45 million a year. Biden's precise intentions for Guantanamo remain unclear. Transition spokesman Ned Price said the president-elect supports closing it, but it would be inappropriate to discuss his plans in detail before he's in office. The detention center opened in 2002. President George W. Bush's administration transformed what had been a sleepy Navy outpost on Cuba's southeastern tip into a place to interrogate and imprison people suspected of links to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban after the September 11, 2001 attacks. At its peak in 2003, the year Paracha was captured in Thailand because of suspected ties to Al-Qaeda, Guantanamo held about 700 prisoners from nearly 50 countries. Bush announced his intention to close it, though 242 were still held there when his presidency ended. The Obama administration, seeking to allay concerns that some of those released had returned to the fight, set up a process to ensure those repatriated or resettled in third countries no longer posed a threat. It also planned to try some of the men in federal court, but his closure effort was thwarted when Congress barred the transfer of prisoners from Guantanamo to the U.S., including for prosecution or medical care. Obama ended up releasing 197 prisoners, leaving 41 for Trump. Trump and his 2016 campaign promised to load Guantanamo with some bad dudes, but largely ignored the issue after rescinding Obama's policies. His administration approved a single release, a Saudi, who pleaded guilty before a military commission. Of those remaining, seven men have cases pending before a military commission. They include five men accused of planning and supporting the September 11th attacks. Additionally, there are two prisoners who were convicted by commission and three facing potential prosecution for the 2002 Bali bombing. The remaining detainees include five who have been cleared for release before Trump took office and have languished since. Advocates want the Biden administration to review the rest. Whittle it down to the folks who are being prosecuted, and either prosecute them or don't. Just don't hang on to them, said Joseph Margulis, a Cornell law professor who has represented one prisoner. At great expense, we walk around this thing with this thing around our necks. It does no good. And from Kim Helmgard and Deidre Seshgreen for the USA Today, Iran vows revenge for assassination. Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei on Saturday vowed the country would take revenge for the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and insisted his death would have no impact on Iran's nuclear knowledge. Fakhrizadeh was an Iranian scientist Israel had credited with masterminding the Islamic Republic's now defunct covert military nuclear program. He was assassinated outside Tehran on Friday. Khamenei called Fakhrizadeh the country's prominent and distinguished nuclear and defensive scientist. He added that Iran's first priority after the killing was the definitive punishment of the perpetrators and those who ordered it. Speaking earlier Saturday, President Hassan Rouhani blamed Israel for the killing. "We will respond to the assassination of martyr Fakhrizadeh in a proper time. There are no immediate claims of responsibility." And in the Nation and World Watch, from Milwaukee, experts caution COVID-19 data from Holiday could be misread. The coronavirus testing numbers that have guided much of the nation's response to the pandemic are likely to be erratic over the next week or so, experts said Friday, as fewer people get tested during the holiday weekend and testing sites observe shorter hours. The result could be apparent dips in reported infections that offer the illusion that the spread of the virus is easing, when in fact the numbers say little about where the nation stands in fighting COVID-19. A similar pattern unfolds on many weekends. From Sacramento, California, two shot killed at Northern California Mall on Black Friday. Police are looking for a gunman who shot and killed two teens at a mall in the midst of Black Friday, sending shoppers running for safety. Arden Fair Mall in Sacramento was emptied shortly after 6 p.m. when shots were fired near one of the mall's entrances. Police spokesman Carl Chan said, "A 19-year-old man was found dead at the mall and a 17-year-old boy found critically wounded at a bank outside of the mall succumbed to his injuries several hours later," police told the Sacramento Bee on Saturday. Temporary U.S. Pentagon chief makes rare visit to Somalia. The Pentagon's acting defense secretary has made a rare visit to Somalia, a conflict-plagued nation in the Horn of Africa where American forces have been assisting in the fight against Al-Qaeda affiliate Al-Shabaab. The Pentagon said Christopher Miller met Friday with U.S. troops in Mogadishu to express appreciation for their work and to reiterate the U.S. commitment to combating extremist groups. Just hours after Miller's visit, the Somali government announced that a suicide bombing in Mogadishu had killed at least 7 people. And finally, from El Salvador. El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala stage mass raids on gangs. The Central American countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras have rounded up hundreds of suspected gang members as parts of a U.S.-backed effort known as Operation Regional Shield. The Attorney General's office in El Salvador has taken the lead, reporting that it obtained arrest warrants for 1,152 suspects, of whom 572 had been arrested by Friday. The week-long effort particularly targeted members of the Barrio 18 and the MS-13 gangs, which operate in all three countries. From Qasim Abdulzara, writing for the Associated Press, 5 killed at march for Iraqi cleric. Dateline Baghdad. Supporters of a firebrand Iraqi cleric shot dead 5 people on Saturday, according to medical officials, in overnight clashes with anti-government protesters in southern Iraq. The anti-government demonstrators attempted to block the path of a rally supporting Shiite Muslim leader Muqtada al-Sadr. Followers of the populist cleric also wounded 40 others in the course of the clashes, according to 2 medical officials. The officials spoke on condition of anonymity in line with regulations. The anti-government protesters were camped out at a main square in the city of Nasiriyah. The place had been an epicenter of the youth-led protest movement that has sought to sweep aside Iraq's ruling sectarian elite. Following the clashes beginning Friday, al-Sadr's supporters stormed the square and torched tents pitched in the square. Al-Sadr leads a powerful political bloc in Iraqi parliament, and his supporters had called for a demonstration in support of the leader's call for mass participation in next year's nationwide elections. Anti-government protesters feel betrayed by al-Sadr's flip-flop approach toward them, especially in the last few months when he made the decision to withdraw support for their movement. Dozens returned to the anti-government sit-in site on Saturday morning in support of those protesters who were killed overnight. Kara Anna, writing for the Associated Press, Ethiopian military now controls Tigray capital. Police pursuing leaders in contentious region. Dateline, Nairobi, Kenya. Ethiopia's military has gained full control At the capital of the defiant Tigray region, the army announced Saturday after the Tigray government reported that the city of 500,000 people was being heavily bombarded in the final push to arrest the region's leaders. God bless Ethiopia and its people, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said in a statement declaring that the taking marked the completion of the military offensive that started nearly 4 weeks ago. We have entered the city without innocent civilians being targets, he said. Now, the police will pursue the arrest of the leaders of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, who run the region and dominated Ethiopia's ruling coalition before Abiy came to power in 2018 and sidelined them among the sweeping reforms that won him the Nobel Peace Prize. We now have ahead of us the critical task of rebuilding what has been destroyed, with the most priority of returning normalcy to the people of the Tigray region, Abiy said. The fighting has threatened to destabilize Ethiopia, which has been described as the linchpin of the strategic Horn of Africa and its neighbors. As international alarm has grown since the conflict began on November 4th, so has a massive humanitarian crisis. The Tigray region of 6 million people has been cut off from the world as the military pursued what Abiy called a law enforcement operation with airstrikes and tanks. Food, fuel, cash, and medical supplies have run desperately low. Humanitarians and human rights groups have said several hundred people have been killed. Nearly 1 million people have been displaced, including more than 40,000 who fled into Sudan. Camps home to 96,000 Eritrean refugees in northern Tigray have been in the line of fire. Alarm spiked anew on Saturday as Ethiopian forces appeared to be realizing the final phase of the conflict. The United Nations continues to ask for immediate and unimpeded access for aid deliveries. The Office of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he has expressed his grave concern over the consequences of the Ethiopian conflict to the civilian population and over the spread of hate speech and reports of ethnic profiling. Among Abiy's goals is welcoming back the refugees who fled, though many have reported being attacked by Ethiopian forces and now struggle to find food, shelter, and care in a remote part of Sudan. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi said Saturday, visiting Sudan's Rabuka refugee camp, which houses some 10,000 of the new Ethiopian refugees, he said about $150 million is needed over the next 6 months to help Sudan manage the influx. We have seen the figure of people declining, but continuing. 500 to 600 per day is not a small figure. Let's make no mistake. It is true, there were days in which they were in their thousands, but it depends also on the difficulty of moving around their country and on the border, Grandi said. And the photograph that accompanies this article has a caption that reads, Filippo Grandi, UN High Commissioner for Refugees, says about $150 million is needed to help Sudan manage refugees from Ethiopia. And it shows some people wearing masks who are talking to people who are sitting on the ground, who I would assume are the refugees, and they are unmasked. Kara Anna also writes for the Associated Press, U.S. pullout could hurt Somalia. Dismay as troop withdrawal considered. Dateline Nairobi, Kenya. No country has been involved in Somalia's future as much as the United States. Now the Trump administration is thinking of withdrawing the several hundred U.S. military troops from the Horn of Africa nation at what some experts call the worst possible time. 3 decades of chaos, from warlords to Al-Qaeda affiliate, to the emergence of an Islamic State-linked group, have ripped apart the country that only in the past few years has begun to find its footing. The U.S. Embassy returned to Somalia just last year, 28 years after diplomats and staffers fled. Somalia faces a tense election season that begins in the next few weeks to decide the presidency and parliament. United Nations experts say Al-Shabaab supporting its 5,000 to 10,000 fighters on a rich diet of extorting businesses and civilians is improving its bomb-making skills, and an ever-bigger military force, the Africa Union's 19,000-strong AMISOM, has begun its own withdrawal from a country whose forces are widely considered unready to assume full responsibility for security. It's not clear whether President Donald Trump will order the withdrawal of the some 700 U.S. military forces now in Somalia, following his orders for Afghanistan and Iraq, or whether the reported urge will pass before he leaves office in January. But the idea is taken seriously, even as U.S. drone strikes are expected to continue in Somalia against al-Shabaab and ICE fighters from neighboring Kenya. The U.S. Africa Command has seen a definitive shift this year in al-Shabaab's focus to attack U.S. interests in the region, a new report by the Department of Defense Inspector General said Wednesday. And the command says al-Shabaab is Africa's most dangerous and imminent threat. What is at stake? Counterterrorism. The first thing, it's disastrous for Somalia's security sector. It just causes that first panic reaction. You know, why now? Said Samira Gayad, a Somali national security specialist who served as senior security advisor to the prime minister and special advisor to the head of AMISOM. Especially since over the past 3.5 years, in particular, the security sector really improved and we tried to work closely with the United States, she told the Associated Press. Recent progress includes a war council between the U.S. and Somali government, she said, where the U.S. helps to draw up military plans. The U.S. military also trains Somalia's elite Danab Special Forces that now number around 1,000 and is providing Danab with air cover and intelligence, Gayad said. Danab was expanding, and that's why this is so shocking, she said. Is it possible to move forward with that plan now? Danab units are now operational in 4 of Somalia's 5 member states, the U.S. military says, and they conducted about 80% of the Somali National Army's offensive forces in the quarter ending September 30th, and nearly all operations against al-Shabaab. The Danab forces also serve as a model for how the rest of the Somali military forces can develop to be more meritocracy and less clan-focused, said Omar Mahmoud, an analyst with the International Crisis Group. The loss of U.S. forces is widely seen as a gain for al-Shabaab and for the far smaller presence of hundreds of IS-affiliated fighters in Somalia's north. Al-Shabaab's messaging has always stressed the extremist group's staying power, national security specialist Gayad said. These external forces will always leave. A U.S. withdrawal will play into that narrative. Gayad said she doesn't see any other country stepping into the U.S. military's role, though a withdrawal could open space for powers like Russia and China. Without U.S. forces, al-Shabaab will find it easier to overrun AMISOM, let alone the Somali National Army. Vanda Feeble Brown, a co-director of the African Security Initiative at the Brookings Institute, told an online event this week, and with neighboring Ethiopia's conflict increasing pressure to withdraw more Ethiopian forces from Somalia, a U.S. troop withdrawal is really just the worst time. The support the U.S. forces give AMISOM is huge, Gayad said, including as a key interlocutor with Somali forces and with AMISOM also drawing down by the end of next year. It's a tricky time. The U.S. has said implementation of the plan for Somali forces to take over the country's security next year is badly off track, said the new report by the Department of Defense Inspector General. Somali forces cannot contain the al-Shabaab threat on their own, the report said. They still rely on the international community for financial support, and yet they sometimes go unpaid for months. A withdrawal of both the U.S. and AMISOM would risk leaving the impression that Somalia increasingly can rely less and less on external security partners, Mahmoud said. Somalia is on the brink of elections, and with the parliamentary vote scheduled in December and the presidential one in February, what had meant to be the country's first one-person, one-vote election in decades instead remains limited by disputes between the federal government and the regional ones, which the U.S. has said also weakens command and control of Somali forces. At least keep U.S. forces in Somalia until after the elections, Feeba Brown wrote this week, warning of possible post-election violence or al-Shabaab taking advantage of any chaos. Even though U.S. forces don't provide election security, our problem is, with the U.S. focused on a downdraw, or drawdown of troops, it would not be focused on how the elections are going politically, Gayad said. The U.S. has been one of the most vocal actors on Somalia's election process, she said. We're all expecting after November that the U.S. would be clear on a lot of stuff, and now it seems like we have to wait. And the photograph accompanying this article has a caption that reads, "The Trump administration is thinking of withdrawing U.S. military troops from Somalia." And it's kind of a cool picture, photograph. It's a soldier in the background. You can see the Milky Way. So it was taken at night, and the soldier is in silhouette. Next, we'll go to the opinion page of the Des Moines Register. And our first editorial is a Your Turn, written by Casey Erickson. The Illusion of Des Moines Cultural Transformation. The demise of Vaudeville Muse helps unveil what was wrong about Richard Florida's prescriptions for urban revitalization and what might be done for the local art scene now. The Vaudeville Muse functioned for the last 18 years as more than just a music venue and bar. It was a home, the default location for Des Moines music community and a key hub for Des Moines' much-flaunted creative renaissance. For up-and-coming local musicians and regional bands embarking on their first tours, the low cost of booking a show at the Muse gave them the freedom to explore their creativity and build networks of support and collaboration. That the Muse has closed is utterly devastating, and yet, at the same time, I can't help but thinking that it was predictable, even inevitable. The function that the Muse served, providing artists with the room and freedom to experiment and fail, to learn and grow, is not something that easily lends itself to profit and commodification. The process of creating authentic culture is, for the most part, inefficient and wasteful. I couldn't tell you the number of shows I've been to where the crowd was outnumbered by the musicians on stage. These shows, it must be said, are among the best shows I saw there. When the Muse storefront is eventually gutted, renovated, and reopened as a more traditional bar or a late-night restaurant, I'm sure that the building owner will enjoy more reliable returns and that property values downtown will continue to rise. But the culture of the city will be immeasurably poorer for it. The closure of the Muse, coming less than a year after the closure of the Des Moines Social Club, and amid immense social turmoil surrounding economic inequality, state violence, and an unprecedented pandemic, should prompt us to reflect back on the 15 years long project to rebuild downtown Des Moines into a creative hub based in part on the theories of economist Richard Florida. Creative class believers drove high profile projects. Florida, in a 2002 book, The Rise of the Creative Class, hailed the deindustrialization of urban areas as an opportunity to transform them from homes and workplaces for their working class residents into playgrounds for upper middle class creative and managerial workers. Florida made a fortune traveling the country, encouraging cities to invest in amenities that would be attractive to his creative class. Des Moines city leaders have, for the most part, uncritically accepted his theories and followed his advice. As a Politico magazine article from 2016 detailed, Des Moines leaders started in 1987, but picking up precipitously in the mid-2000s during the popularization of Florida's ideas, began funding various projects aimed at making living in downtown Des Moines more attractive to the creative young professionals Florida wrote about. These projects, such as the Science Center, the Papa John Sculpture Park, the Principal Riverwalk, almost took the shape of public-private partnerships, wherein public money is used in furtherance of private goals and private decision-making. For a time, these efforts appeared to bear fruit. Residents in downtown and East Village neighborhoods skyrocketed, businesses flourished, and the thriving culture seemed to be taking root. Des Moines climbed to the top of countless superlative lists purporting to categorize great places to live, and many started touting the city as the next great metropolitan cultural hub after places like Austin outlived their hype. Zachary Mannheimer and his Des Moines Social Club existed in this mythology as the crown jewel of Des Moines' legitimacy as a creative incubator. Here was a young creative person who had been squeezed out of New York and found fertile land to grow on in Des Moines, of all places. The unprecedented success of the Des Moines Social Club, funded largely by corporate donations, rather than any kind of grassroots membership fees, making clubs something of a misnomer, was held up as a shining example of Des Moines' open-mindedness and cooperative spirit. That the social club ultimately failed has received scant publicity compared with the breathless coverage of its meteoric rise. After news of the nonprofit folding and brief discussion by city leaders of transforming the historic fireplace it once occupied into a public market, plans that are on hold, if not scrapped, nothing much has been written about the era in our city that it seems to represent. Creatives aren't a monolith and art isn't free. The deaths of the Des Moines Social Club and the Vaudeville Muse seems to me indicative of the fundamental contradictions inherent in the problem of culture and economics that are left largely unacknowledged by Florida and acolytes here in Des Moines. At the most basic level, Florida's conception of creative workers as a class ignores the economic stratification that exists between, say, tech entrepreneurs and independent musicians who work as bartenders and baristas. For the vast majority of artists, making art is not profitable. Throughout history, most art, or at least most financially successful art, has always been subsidized by the state, either through royal patronage or public programs and grants like those that began under the New Deal in the 1930s. It has become increasingly vogue to view art and culture as commodities, and private collectors, investors, and foundations have usurped the role of the state in the funding of art. It is important to remember that this was not always the case. During the New Deal, our government made massive investments in all kinds of art, from the Works Progress Administration murals that were supervised by Grant Wood, the Federal Theater Project overseen by Grinnell's Haley Flanagan, and the public works projects that created parks, monuments, and even Art Deco fire stations, like the one that briefly housed the Social Club. The New Deal art programs provided an essential safety net for all kinds of artists to explore and experiment, to exchange ideas and challenge each other. So many essential artists from the last century, from Orson Welles and Lee Krasner to Ralph Ellison and Zora Neale Hurston, either got their start working in these programs or received much needed support during the devastating years of the Depression that allowed them to remain committed to their art. If we are to see a true cultural renaissance in Des Moines, it is clear now that it will not be handed to us by the folks at the Greater Des Moines Partnership. It is evident now in the midst of the pandemic as bars stay open and contribute to the spread of a deadly virus while the muse closes that our hopes cannot rest on the generosity of private donors or the viability of private enterprise. If we are to make art and culture viable in Des Moines, and if we aim to make the life of an artist amount to more than mere survival, we must admit now that the power to do this will never be handed to us. We have to take it. The artistic programs and investments of the New Deal era do not exist in a vacuum. They were not created by President Roosevelt out of a sense of charity or good feeling. These programs were a result of concerted political struggle. The artists of the day were fully integrated with the broader political and labor movements struggling for fundamental changes to our economic system. These artists organized and agitated. They recognized that their struggle was the same struggle as that of the farmer and the factory worker and the homemaker, and they fought tirelessly for substantive material gains, combining causes to effect real social change. If we are to replicate their efforts, we must recognize that our present struggles are intertwined as well. The protests against police violence have shown us that the power to change this city can fall into our hands if we organize together and fight for that change. If we can build a coalition of the movements for racial, economic, and environmental justice to challenge the existing power structure, we can institute a dignified living wage, a 30-hour work week, and an end to rent as we know it for residential and small commercial purposes. These changes, along with many more that may emerge from the movement, could drastically improve the economic viability of artistic life in our city. Building such a coalition is necessary not only to redistribute economic power, but other forms of unearned power and privilege as well. The Des Moines music scene and the Muse, as an extension of it, was not and is not perfect. We face internal problems of misogyny and racism that have resulted in a music scene that has overrepresented white men, both on the stage and behind the scenes. There are a number of people in the community, many of whom work at the Muse, who are working hard to change things, but they need more support. In order to address these inequalities, we must push for radical transparency and accountability at every level of decision-making. And that can only happen when artists and their audiences can build sustainable communities based on the principles of democracy and solidarity. It is time for us to recognize that art and culture, like education or the environment, or are universal public goods deserving of government subsidy and common accessibility. To the people who are devastated today by the death of the Muse, know that I share your pain deeply. So much of what I know about life that has any value, I learned in the Muse, and almost all of the relationships in my life that I treasure most dearly started in that room. I take comfort today in the words of Joe Hill, a legendary immigrant, labor organizer, and songwriter who wrote to a friend just before his death, "Don't waste any time mourning, organize." Casey Arizin is a kitchen worker in Des Moines. Our next editorial is a Your Turn column written by Suzanne Bartlett Hacken-Miller. It's titled, "We All Need to Find Healing in Nature and an Ambitious Trip Isn't Required." The cool scent of white pine intermingles with the sweet freshness of new grass, both fragrances enhanced by the previous night's rain. A blast of wind brings a waft of flowering crabapple that fills my being. Surrounding me are dried pine needles, leaves, and fractured acorn hats. A squirrel darts by, unintimidated. Closing my eyes, my breathing settles as the natural elements bathe my senses. A car blaring loud music interrupts my moment. The wind shifts to deliver an enticing aroma from the Pakistani restaurant nearby. I notice the bench's cold concrete surface, the broken bricks beneath my feet, some litter on the ground. Exhaling, I gaze upward and redirect my attention to the swaying treetops, drifting clouds, and a crow in flight. In 20 minutes, I have become immersed in nature amid a bustling college community. In 20 minutes, my heart rate has dropped and my mind has cleared. When we think of nature, we often envision majestic landscapes, large bodies of water, deep forests, and snow-capped mountains. When we learn about nature's health benefits, we often conclude that access to magnificent settings is required to achieve them. Worldwide, people are sheltering in place to reduce the spread of the novel coronavirus, which causes COVID-19. But just when nature's healing effects are most crucial, traveling to local, much less national, parks is not always possible. The question arises, how can we experience nature's healing benefits close to home? Pandemic life is stressful, and mental stress weakens the immune system, but time in nature strengthens it. Studies have found, for example, that trees emit chemicals called phytoncides that boost our immune function by strengthening the body's natural killer cells. These immune mediators trap and consume viruses as one of the many ways our bodies fight disease. A 2019 study published in Frontiers in Psychology found that a 20-minute nature experience reduces the levels of two markers of stress found in saliva, cortisol and alpha amylase. High levels of these markers strain the immune system, so spending 20 minutes outdoors reduces stress, which in turn strengthens the immune system. Could 20 minutes of nature at home do the same? I asked some experts to weigh in. Dr. Kathleen Wolf, research scientist in the School of Environmental and Forest Sciences at the University of Washington, and Mickey Fern, former National Park Service Deputy Director for Communications and Community Assistance and Professor of Practice at North Carolina State University's School of Natural Resources. According to a 2016 Nature Sacred article by Wolf, over 80% of the United States population lives in cities. Despite the Trust for Public Lands initiative that all Americans live within a 10-minute walk to a park, this is not yet a reality. Even if it were, nature access is a challenge during COVID. Nearby nature, to me, is nature with a small n, Wolf says. It doesn't have a definition so much as that it is about the experience. She draws the last word out until it is palpable. Experience. Americans, she continues, have this propensity to think of real nature, capital N nature, as something that is beyond the city. In other words, we think of nature as someplace far away and inaccessible. Wolf and I discuss nearby nature in its smallest forms and agree on its health merits. She mentions a study concluding that post-surgical recovery is improved by having a potted plant in a hospital room. It's about changing our perspective, Wolf concludes. That dandelion, that bird, that tree along the street is not part of our social construction of nature, she says, but it should be, especially now. Mickey Fearn confirms our thinking when he says nature is a basic need, basic health need, not a luxury. And he is a man whose words convey wisdom, a tireless 50-year leader in the fields of conservation and diversity. Fearn marched with Martin Luther King Jr. and served in the Obama administration. We take people to nature, but then we return them to their habitat, he says. It is about recognizing that the healing effects of nature exist within that habitat, he and I decide. Thinking about nature as that thing we go to is a mistake, he emphasizes. The challenge, then, is to share with people, particularly those who live in cities, this notion of interacting with nearby nature. Sitting on a sidewalk by my home, I notice a resilient dandelion pushing through a 5-millimeter crack. Its full spray of jagged leaves fans out from the center, undeterred by daily trampling. Two fluffy golden flower heads sit atop the bed of leaves. Leaning in, the softness tickles my nose and invokes childhood butter memories. Perhaps we can reframe our experience of nature during this era of COVID and find healing in small, mindful 20-minute doses in unlikely places, on a porch, a balcony, out the window, or even with an indoor potted plant. Nearing my own 20-minute mark on the sidewalk, I watched ants scurry around the dandelion and became engrossed in a microcosm that we typically ignore if not to test. A head-to-toe scan reveals wellness and peace. Not even the noise of nearby construction can detract from my healing encounter in nature with a lowercase n. Dr. Suzanne Bartlett Hackenmiller is an OBGYN, an integrative physician who lives in Cedar Falls. She is also an international speaker, consultant, and author of The Outdoor Adventurer's Guide to Forest Bathing. The Register's editorial today is titled, Iowa National Guard Needed for Nursing Home Emergency. Troops could deliver meals, ensure proper use of protective equipment, coordinate visits with family, and assist hundreds of understaffed facilities. When a restaurant's cooks, servers, and delivery drivers must quarantine because of COVID-19, the business has little choice but to close. The same goes for schools, banks, hair salons, and other establishments that are abruptly and temporarily closing. But nursing homes cannot just hang a sign on the door and close when staff are sick or need to isolate. Their patrons are living there. Staff need to provide around-the-clock care. Iowa nursing homes are in serious trouble. As of Tuesday, the state was reporting 144 COVID-19 outbreaks in long-term care facilities. Iowa defines an outbreak as three or more residents or staff testing positive. Nearly half of the Iowans who have died from the disease were nursing home residents. The COVID-19 fire is raging in long-term care facilities, and this is a crisis. Governor Kim Reynolds should call on the Iowa National Guard to provide assistance. We are in a war here, said John Hale, a consultant and advocate for Iowa seniors who supports the idea of asking troops for help. He is understandably frustrated with state staffing guidelines for long-term care facilities that allow staff who test positive to continue working. This plays Russian roulette with residents, Hale said. The state's guidelines, which include suggestions to share staff and create work groups, assume that there are enough workers to share, trade, relocate, or call in, and there are not. There are also not new job applicants banging down the door to work at COVID-19 hotspots. Iowa already had a shortage of caregivers, and now the situation has gone from bad to worse. It makes sense to utilize the National Guard. During this pandemic, governors across the country have called on troops for everything from transporting supplies to helping with call centers to building medical field hospitals. Members of the Texas National Guard were recently mobilized to El Paso to help with a morgue crisis as the state battles a surge in coronavirus deaths. 36 troops are providing mortuary affairs support, such as helping move bodies, according to the Texas Division of Emergency Management. Reynolds has relied on Guard members to assist in test Iowa sites and with contact tracing for people who test positive for the virus. In nursing homes, troops could perform important tasks such as ensuring protective equipment is used properly and delivering meals to residents. They could help facilitate teleconferencing or outdoor distance visits between residents and loved ones, which is desperately needed. Too many long-term care facilities have banned visitors from the grounds, even posting guards at parking lot entrances. This prevents family and friends from visiting, even across a balcony outdoors. Residents have already lost community meals and activities. Some are told they cannot leave. Widows and widowers eat alone in their rooms. They may not know how to use email or teleconferencing tools to connect with others. They may have a hard time hearing on the phone. Banning visitors exacerbates isolation, loneliness, and depression, which contribute to declines in health. Additional staffing from the National Guard can make all the difference in improving quality of life and safety in long-term care facilities. Troops also bring expertise in medical care, logistics, and other areas. Reynolds has the authority to call up troops to respond to emergencies. Iowa's long-term care facilities are in a state of emergency. Where will the $14 million for nursing homes go? Governor Kim Reynolds recently announced that long-term care facilities in Iowa will receive $14 million from the state's share of federal coronavirus relief funds to help with staffing and testing needs. The best use of this money would be providing immediate bonuses directed to certified nursing assistants and other direct care workers. Caregivers have long been in short supply. They are underpaid, frequently lack benefits, and are now putting their lives on the line to take care of our most vulnerable Iowans during an infectious disease pandemic. Valuing them by financially rewarding them is the least that Iowa can do. And in letters to the editor, from David Russell of Ames, impossible to enforce stop signs. Do we really need a complete and total stop sign mandate in Iowa? I don't think we need a law that requires Iowans to stop every single time at stop signs and lights. I'm sure Kim Reynolds would agree. It is nearly impossible to completely enforce. There simply aren't enough police to patrol the thousands and thousands of stop signs and lights in the state. Besides, Iowans can take personal responsibility for stopping when there's traffic coming. We're not fools in this state, are we? What real Iowan wants nanny state liberals telling us what to do every time we get behind the wheel? To those so-called traffic experts who say we'll have more accidents and even fatalities if we end the total mandate, I would just echo Governor Kim Reynolds when she said about a similar issue, we'll just have to learn to live with it. So what if there are a few more injuries or deaths when we end the mandate? It's a small price to pay for maintaining our constitutionally protected freedoms. Put an end to stop sign tyranny. From Thomas J. Malley of Altoona, we'll be worse off without Trump in office. After reading David Skidmore's November 22nd essay, hashtag resist was a success, deserves to be raised. At what cost did hashtag resist win? As a consequence of hashtag resist, there has been a huge destruction in a number of cities with businesses destroyed and lives lost. Police departments are now being underfunded and officers are leaving the profession. Tragically, killing of police officers has increased significantly, the FBI reported this summer. All of the above looks like a very high price to pay for resistance to succeed. Early on, President Donald Trump erased the Islamic State, which arguably was good for Muslims in the world. Does it matter that several countries in the Middle East are moving toward relationship with Israel? Can you say Nobel Peace Prize? Immigrants also have fared quite well as the torrents of immigrants coming to the border slowed dramatically during the Trump administration. Fewer people are risking their lives or being abused by traffickers, cartels, and coyotes. Thankfully, Trump rid us of those dedicated public servants, James Comey, John Brennan, James Clapper, Peter Strzok, and Lisa Page. That looks like skimming at least a bit of the pond scum off of the deep state. I hesitate to begin the litany of other accomplishments of the Trump administration because he is brash, a bully, exaggerates, lies, and is not politically correct. They do not count anyways. From Jody Gibson of Des Moines, relief bill needed as soon as possible. People struggling here and around the world have been waiting for months for Congress to pass an emergency COVID-19 response bill. What is Congress not understanding about this emergency? Projections are that global hunger will double and thousands of infants will suffer or die of severe malnutrition. An estimated 80 million children are at risk of vaccine-preventable disease for lack of access to regular health services. AIDS, TB, and malaria cases and deaths are projected to rise to levels we haven't seen in 10 to 20 years. What can be more important for members of Congress right now than doing their job? I'm calling on our senators and representatives to get creative, fight, prioritize, and not give up on passing an emergency COVID-19 package that includes at least $20 billion in funding for global health and nutrition to help those struggling in lower-income countries. From Jerry Neeson of Cedar Falls, we should be fighting for, not against, one another. I am concerned that political tribalism threatens to become more important than the good of the country. I'll know representative government is still strong when it represents the will of the people, not the most wealthy lobbyists. I believe our democracy is strong when both parties are working to expand voting rights and make it easier for all eligible Americans to vote. I know we're doing okay when political rivals have the intelligence and character to recognize the value and patriotism of their opponents. I'll know democracy will survive when political debate is based on demonstrable facts, not what someone wished were true. We are a casserole of cultures and ideas. This great diversity is what makes our country great and deserves to be celebrated, not feared. Let's stop fighting with one another long enough to remember that we should be fighting for one another. From Catherine Bennett of Burlington, we have to exercise social responsibility. Personal choice is the term used by those who feel they have the right to decline masks and determine individual or family risk for the coronavirus. After some choose to take risks by gathering this holiday season, infections will rise and so will hospitalizations. This affects all medical providers and caregivers. A primary population at risk is the elderly in residential centers. In order to reduce virus spread, few opportunities for limited family visits have been available since March. For many in nursing homes, isolation is required. These people have no choice. Their families have not abandoned them, but the community and the state have. This holiday season will be bleak for many living in care centers, while others exercise personal choice to gather and keep the virus going viral. From Ann Lioness of Boone, still waiting. It's time for Senator Joni Ernst and Senator Chuck Grassley to step up and acknowledge President-elect Joe Biden. After all, during the impeachment of Donald Trump, the Republican Party would not convict him, saying, let the people decide. I believe they did. So what are they waiting for? From Meredith McLean of Des Moines, millions at risk of going hungry. I am fairly concerned about the increase in hunger during this pandemic. Less than half of families with children are very confident they can afford to put food on the table this holiday season, according to the latest Census Bureau research. People are being forced to choose between rent and groceries. Some leaders in Congress are ignoring this hidden hunger crisis, dragging their feet on any food assistance for families. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program in our nation's first line is our nation's first line of defense against hunger, and it helps our economy recover. Every dollar in new SNAP spending creates more economic activity. There has been some bipartisan support in Congress to increase SNAP benefits during this crisis. I urge our members of Congress to resume COVID-19 relief negotiations now and quickly pass legislation that increases the maximum SNAP benefit by 15%. And finally, from Mary McBee of Tama, on the role of government. What is democratic government if not a structure set up to serve the well-being of the people? Is it not meant to serve the common good and to protect the welfare and safety of the public? Governments are called upon to intrude upon lives for the sake of our general welfare in many ways, taxes for one, but especially for service during wars or pandemics. Conservative Republicans prize individual freedom, demanding that no government has a right to exercise a mandate for wearing masks in public or to avoid meeting and gatherings. Yet these are obviously for the safety of the common good. However, in direct contrast, conservative Republicans do want the government to intrude upon private and personal lives far beyond the common good by deciding what a woman can do with her own body. If that isn't hypocrisy, I don't know what is. Another guest editorial comes from Sue Dinsdale. Congress must resolve expiration of paid leave. This New Year's Eve won't be so happy for many who are unable to work due to the pandemic. Why? On December 31st, paid leave protection for Iowans and Americans will expire. Senator Joni Ernst and Senator Chuck Grassley must put aside party politics and focus on the needs of Iowans before it is too late. Back in March, both of our senators voted for the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, but when it came to the paid leave portion, they were each a resounding no on this important part of the act. What they do and what they say are entirely different stories. Grassley responded to passage of the Response Act by saying, "In this package, we increase both paid sick leave and paid family leave to ensure people can stay home to stop the spread of coronavirus, as well as ensure that these measures are funded so employers across the country don't run into cash flow problems that threaten their businesses." At a news conference in March, Ernst praised the paid sick leave provision for the coronavirus relief package. She even went so far as to remark that a significant part of phase two was also making sure that our workers, our moms and dads, have paid sick leave, emergency sick leave, so that if they were affected by the coronavirus, then they would be covered for the time that they had to take away from their employer. Their comments, however, don't ring true. Both of our senators supported and voted for the Johnson Amendment, which would have removed paid sick leave and family leave from the act. And each voted no on the Murray Amendment, which would have closed loopholes to cover more workers with the paid leave they need during this crisis. We keep hearing our senators praise essential and frontline workers, but we need more of them. We need action. In May, that U.S. House approves the HEROES Act, which would close those loopholes in the existing law that excludes millions of America's workers. The law would expand coverage to employees of businesses with more than 500 employees and to healthcare workers, emergency responders, and small business employees left out or underprotected under current law. In addition, the HEROES Act would expand paid leave protections by providing extended paid leave for a broader range of purposes, covering additional health and caregiving needs, and extending the emergency paid leave provisions through 2021. Iowans are facing impossible choices, forcing us to choose between job and family. We need our elected representatives to prioritize protecting Iowans during this pandemic and focus on the relief that is sorely needed. COVID-19 has taught us that paid leave saves jobs and saves lives. We know we need a common sense solution to address the paid leave crisis, a solution that extends beyond December 31st, expiration of the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. We know we need a national paid leave plan that covers all Americans. Sue Dinsdale is the director of Iowa Citizen Action Network and leads the Paid Leave for All Coalition in Iowa. And today's political cartoon is drawn by Joel Pett for the Tribune Content Agency, and it shows a piece of music with the title, "I'll Be Home for Christmas," but instead it says, "I'll Still Be Home at Christmas," with two exclamation points and an unhappy face following that. That's it for our second hour of the Register on Iris. We are so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.